probably going to get through the majority of the portion of this text. As you've noticed, there is, once again, the utilization of the symbolic language throughout the course of the book, especially as Daniel's describing this vision that he's witnessed. We talked about there being some similarities between chapter 7 and 8, and once again, this is one of the elements where we see that overlap. We see here Daniel describing these two beasts, and after the horn of the goat, the notorious horn of the goat, breaks off, four smaller horns come up, and we'll look at what that symbolically represents. One of the things coming up, one of those small horns that comes up, is this other small horn. Now, back in chapter 7, we made a real big deal about the little horn that came up in place of the three on the head of the fourth beast. And we looked and we saw how that was representative of the persecuting emperors of Rome, or perhaps Emperor Domitian himself, who was the great persecutor of the Jews. We understand horns are symbolic of power and authority. And unlike the horn of chapter 7, whom we can't be sure to identify, we can look at this horn here and we can look at what history tells us, and we can say beyond a shadow of a doubt, we know who it is, this little horn is, that comes up. And we'll get into that and we'll demonstrate that point throughout the course of our lesson. Once again, the idea being this leader is going to rise of this one world power. They're going to have this somewhat inflated sense of self-worth. And what they think that they're able to accomplish or going to accomplish, and the stamp that they're going to leave on the world, is going to be less significant than the effect that they truly have in that position of power. But also, similarly, like this horn of Daniel 7, this little horn that comes up, and this one here we see grows great toward the beautiful land, this little horn is going to also persecute the people of God. So I was going to pick on Johnny and make him answer that this week, but I don't see him out here. Does anyone want to take a stab at who this little horn may be from the Grecian Empire? It may be a name that you've heard, perhaps if you recall history or if you've studied this chapter before in any detail. We can identify the little horn spoken of here by Daniel, prophesied by Daniel in Daniel chapter 8, as none other than Antiochus Epiphanes. Let's take a moment to look here a little bit. Daniel describes this big horn that breaks, and as a result of the united Grecian and Macedonian Empire, which was united under Alexander the Great, after he died and it kind of broke off, he handed power to various people of influence on his deathbed. He gave some to his generals and some to others. And after a bunch of fighting amongst themselves, it boils down to essentially four different territories of the Grecian Empire united under these four individuals. And you can see them each highlighted. You've got there the Macedonian Empire, a portion of the Grecian Empire that was led by Cassander. You've got Thrace right there that was led by Lysimachus. Egypt, which was led by Ptolemy. And then the larger portion of the Grecian Empire there, that whatever color you want to call that, that teal or that sea green, led by someone by the name of Seleucus. And it's from this larger portion of the Grecian Empire that Antiochus Epiphanes arose, that is, under the Seleucid Empire. He took the throne around 176 B.C. And just as Daniel describes this little horn coming forth from one of where the big horn's broken off and the four arise, Antiochus Epiphanes sort of arose with a very quiet introduction. He came forth small, just as Daniel described. For one, he was the second son. And as you know, back during those points in time, as a kingdom was passed from father to son, it usually went from the father to the oldest son. He would be the one that would receive the inheritance. Antiochus Epiphanes was the second son. He ends up overthrowing his brother and taking the throne for himself. But whenever you look at his situation, you wouldn't suspect this man would be king because he was second in line of the inheritance. You go back and you look at his life also, much of his younger life was spent in captivity. He was a political prisoner in the Empire of Rome. And so you look at that and you consider, well, there doesn't seem to be a lot of prospect here for this young man, second son, captive in Rome. And compared to Alexander the Great, who had united the four empires, the Grecian Empire, this man was obviously very significant, very small. And that's why he's described as coming forth being very small. But we're also told that as this little horn came forth, it grew great toward the south and toward the east and toward the beautiful land. We understand the political campaigns and the wars that Antiochus Epiphanes led his particular portion of the Grecian Empire on. He would go down into Egypt and he invaded Egypt and he conquered there and expanded his kingdom down there. And most noticeably, as we're going to see pertaining to this vision that Daniel has, it grew great toward the beautiful land. We understand that to be representative of the land of Jerusalem, or the land of the Jews. Antiochus Epiphanes was one of the greatest and most contemptible persecutors which the nation of Israel had dealt with. Short of probably the destruction of Jerusalem, Antiochus Epiphanes in the history of the Jews would have been the most hated, the most wicked, and the most evil persecutor that the Jews ever experienced. And you'll understand why as we delve into a little bit of the history of his relationship with the Jews. But he's a very relevant man here in this chapter. And there kind of is a bust of Antiochus. And he's actually Antiochus the IV Epiphanes. There he is kind of represented there in that bust. But he's very relevant in chapter 8. And when we get over to chapter 11, we're going to find out that once again, he's going to be prophesied and he's going to be spoken about. And we'll deal with some of the details that chapter 11 provides and kind of glance over some of chapter 8 because it's highlighted more and it's addressed more specifically in chapter 11. But he's very relevant to this chapter, so we do want to take a little bit of time and consider what history tells us about this guy. For one, he was thought by many of the historians to be a crazy person. He's a madman. It was said by the historians that Antiochus Epiphanes simply didn't know how to behave as kings. He liked mingling with the common people. And so oftentimes what he would do is he would be found in public bathhouses, trying to integrate himself with the common people. And you can imagine, that's just not how a king behaves. That's not the behavior that one would expect a king of an empire to find himself roaming around, bathing with the commoners. And he would try to find places in some of the local theater performances. He tried to really integrate himself into common society. And so it was said of him that he didn't know how to behave as a king. Significantly, in this chapter, what's going to be very relevant, what history will tell us, is Antiochus Epiphanes had a very Hellenistic spirit. What I mean by that is he sought to take and essentially, I'm going to make a word here, Greekify, that is, make all of his entire empire inherit the Grecian morals, the Grecian gods, the Grecian style of living. He sought to unite all of his nations and all of his subordinates under the Grecian Empire. We know that process as Hellenization. And so his love for the Greek people, his love for the Greek religion and the Greek culture was very frequently seen throughout his rule. And that's where we're going to find the Jews butting heads. And this is why we're going to find motivation for Antiochus Epiphanes' persecution of the Jews. Because you can imagine how the Jews have responded throughout history when someone tried to take and to force on them some other religion. It just didn't take well. It just opposed everything that they stood. And so they're going to reject these demands of Hellenization, which he's going to try to impose on the people of Israel. And as a result, this is going to intensify the persecution because of their rejection. What we see about him is, as we've seen with many others who've come up very boastful and, like I say, descriptive, this little horn, he thought obviously more of himself than he was actually going to accomplish. Like many before him, he was going to seek to deify himself. Coinage was found from the reigns of Antiochus Epiphanes, and on one head there was an emblem of Zeus, which actually was kind of, his image was somewhat obviously featured on that to deify himself in an attempt. And on the other side was the phrase Theos Epiphanes, which means God manifest. And so in an attempt to deify himself, he sent that on the coinage that the people used as they bought and as they sold and as they did business. And so whenever you're looking at your money, we have our presidents on one side and God we trust on the other. He had God manifest, and on the other side he had himself resembling Zeus. And so thus seeking to somewhat deify himself. And this involvement with the Jews that's going to take place in the latter portion of his reign. He plundered the temple near the end of his reign, around 168 or 169 B.C. And he promoted a program that brought Greek institutions to Jerusalem. Now, there were, as there always are, usually among people who claim to be followers of God, there were a group of progressive Jews that were very accepting of this process of Hellenization. This gymnasium was going to be built in Jerusalem. The laws of the Torah, which God's people followed, was going to be changed. And the order of the temple worship was going to be done away with. Has anyone ever heard of the book of 1 Maccabees, 2 Maccabees? I'm sure with Dick and Johnny and several of the others here who were students of history that y'all would have heard of the 1 and 2 Maccabees. Now, they're not found within our inspired canon because of the date which they were written, and the canon was closed at the time these books came into being and came to be discovered. But what they do provide us with is a very interesting historical approach that allows us to fill in the gaps. 1 and 2 Maccabees essentially details the attempt of Antiochus Epiphanes to Hellenize the Jewish people, and as a result of that, their reaction. So I do want to take a minute, and I'll emphasize, this is not by any means inspired, but it does give us somewhat of a historical idea of what's taking place and of what Daniel is prophesying about. This book would have been written several centuries after Daniel had already died and after the Jews found themselves in this situation. But let me just read this small excerpt from 1 Maccabees to you, kind of describing what Antiochus Epiphanes would have done. Many of the people, everyone who forsook the law, joined them, that is the Greeks, and they did evil in the land. They drove Israel into hiding in every place of refuge they had. Now on the 15th day of Chislev, in the 145th year, they erected a desolating sacrilege upon the altar of burnt offering. They also built altars in the surrounding cities of Judah and burnt incense at the doors of the houses and in the streets. The books of the law which they found, they tore to pieces and burned with fire. Where the book of the covenant was found in possession of anyone, or if anyone adhered to the law, the decree of the king condemned him to death. They kept using violence against Israel, against those found month after month in the cities. So as Antiochus Epiphanes began this process of persecuting the Jews, there's going to be a family that arose up that really opposed him and that goes to war and withstands all of his attempts to Hellenize the Jewish people. And that history was chronicled in the books of 1 and 2 Maccabees. That's a small portion from 1 Maccabees chapter 1 that tells a little bit about how the Jewish people had turned away from God and turned away from temple worship and turned away from the Torah, their law, and embrace and accept the works and the teachings of Antiochus Epiphanes. And in an attempt to finally stabilize his empire because of the uprising that were going to take place as a result of his Hellenization and those who were rejecting that among the Jews, he finally did grant conditional amnesty to those Jews that did rebel by ending the ban on the Torah and ending the ban on the persecution of the Jews. So as we read through this, Antiochus Epiphanes is that little horn that's described that grows great toward the beautiful land and that expanded his empires to the west and to the south. And here's some of that strange language that we oftentimes see in this apocalyptic literature. Speaking of that horn that grew great, it says, it grew up to the host of heaven. And it calls, that's verse 10 I'm looking at, and calls some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It's confusing language. And maybe that calls to mind the passage in Matthew chapter 24 where many people say that Jesus is describing end times that are going to be coming. And this is what many of our premillennialist friends may point to and say, these are signs and these are things that are going to take place before the world comes to an end and before Jesus returns and builds his kingdom on earth. All of these terrible things, some of the things that are taking place being the stars falling from heaven. And so we see this little horn here, Antiochus Epiphanes, causing some of the stars to fall from heaven. We need to remember that this is symbolic language that we're talking about. Well, who are these stars falling from heaven alluding to? And what impact was Antiochus Epiphanes having in causing them to come down to earth? Well, some have speculated, those who perhaps like to take a more literal approach to the interpretation of prophecy and of the book of Daniel and other writings like that, they've speculated that, well, these are angels that were the star being described here, stars that are falling from heaven. Others thought that prior to Antiochus Epiphanes truly the worst crimes that he committed against Israel was the fall of the last good priest, who he then is going to come and place these progressive priests in the temple area and in Jerusalem. It was, some have believed it to be the last good priest that was killed as a result of his persecution. Now we can look at this and we can read my interpretation and understanding of this, and if anyone else wants to offer any, that's welcome to hear that. It seems to be to me to be referring to the people of God as the host of heaven. You read verse 11. Verse 11 identifies, that is, the commander, that is, the prince. He magnified himself, he being Antiochus. He magnified himself to be equal with the commander of the host. So we understand that to be God. And what's taking place, Antiochus has put himself on the level of God, at least in his own mind, and as he attempts to do among the people. We understand the commander of, or the prince of the host, to be God. And so who might, well, in turn, these stars be? You jump to kind of the end of the chapter. Verse 24 tells us he's going to destroy mighty men. And this, I know we're jumping ahead, but the last sentence in verse 24 says he's going to destroy mighty men and the holy people. So we know as a result of his persecution of the Jews at this point in time, they seem to be symbolic, verses 11 and 24, to the stars that are falling from heaven because of the persecution which he's going to inflict on God's people. His persecution on the Jews was terrible, and we'll jump into this a little bit later and look at it in more detail, but he desecrated the temple. The temple being the place where the people went and communed with God and where they worshiped God. He desecrated the temple. He required Jewish allegiance to himself and to the Greek gods, which would oppose commandment number one that the Jews followed: you shall have no other gods before me. He relentlessly persecuted those who held true to Judaism and those who held to their faith. All of these were blatant offenses against the commander of heaven and against the people, the host of heaven, that is, the Jews. So not only was he persecuting the Jews, but it was a slap in the face to the God of heaven. And so as we read this and kind of symbolically understand what's taking place here, this was, I believe, the persecution inflicted by this man against the Jews, the stars that fell from heaven that were cast to the earth, who died perhaps because of their resistance to his process to Hellenize all of his empire. Does anyone have any thoughts, comments, questions about anything that we've looked at? The first verses 9 through 14, anything that's been a little confusing? Anything you'd like to add?
Do you have any comments on the time?
We're to the 2300.
Yes.
We're going to get to that in just a little bit.
Yes, we'll look at that. Well,
apparently there was more to the reading that I didn't finish. I thought I just had two slides. We can just kind of conclude our thought here with this, the last part of this reading. On the 25th day of the month, and this is once again speaking of Antiochus Epiphanes and his influence among the Jews, they offered sacrifice on the altar, which was upon the altar of burnt offering. According to the decree, they put to death the women who had their children circumcised and their families and those who circumcised them. And they hung the infants from their mother's necks. But many in Israel stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to eat unclean meat. So you see here just how this culminates, this persecution by Antiochus culminates among the Jews, resisting all that would oppose and withstand his attempt to force Greek worship on these people. And as he changes and outlawed various significant aspects of Judaism, that is circumcision and temple worship and those various things. It says some of the stars fell from heaven there in that passage. And as we read earlier in that passage from 1 Maccabees, the writer records that yes, there were certain ones that gave in to the demands and that were willing to accept and that turned their back on God. But there were also some here we see that were resolved in their hearts. That brings back of Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8. Daniel purposed in his heart. And we see that there were some Jews who stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to turn their back on God and to keep their faith. And so, as a result of that, many of them were killed. And that was, I believe, kind of symbolic of the stars falling from heaven. Miss Johnny, did you have a comment?
Very good.
I did read that, and I'm wanting to say I might have that passage a little bit later, but as Sister Johnny mentioned, one of the desecrations that we see Antiochus Epiphanes doing is implementing pigs into temple worship. And very obviously, when you go back and you look at the stipulations, we talked about this a little bit last week, the clean and the unclean, certain things were to be offered before God, certain things were unclean, and to even as a Jew, to touch those things would make you unclean. But yet, pigs is one of the ways that Antiochus Epiphanes desecrated the temple by forcing the Jews to bring in swine and use them as part of temple worship. And for the Jews, this was about as far gone as you could go. And yet that was part of his persecution and part of his plan to Hellenize the Greek, you know, the Jewish people by imposing these sort of blasphemies into their worship. So we see there the stars falling from heaven, how some of God's people died as a result of their steadfastness to God. And there's Daniel chapter 8 and verse 11 that I briefly mentioned. We see here also identified in this text the removal of the daily sacrifice. And that Dick also mentioned, we'll look at in just a moment, verse 14, that talks about this period of time in which this persecution was going to take place. In 167 BC, once again, history will tell us that ceremonial observations within the temple ceased at that point. In verses 13 and 14 that we just read a moment ago, this conversation is taking place between these two angels. And as Daniel hears these two angels speaking, one is asking the other, how long is this going to take place? How long is the temple of the Lord going to be desecrated? How long is the daily sacrifice going to be removed? Terrible times were ahead for God's people. And you may remember now, it's during the reign of Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians. There's no overt persecution against God's people. And the Medes and the Persians are going to arise, and Cyrus the Persian is going to be the king that is compassionate toward God's people, that allows them to go back and to inhabit Jerusalem once again, rebuild the wall, rebuild the temple, reinstitute temple worship. And so the Medes and the Persians are going to bring forth an empire that's somewhat sympathetic toward God and his people. However, after the Medes and the Persians is the arrival of the Greek Empire. And it's probably 150 years into the Greek Empire before Antiochus Epiphanes comes into play. And this is what Daniel's prophesying, these bad times ahead that are coming for God's people. And so we see there the removal of the daily sacrifice, and these two angels are speaking and taking place, having this conversation and saying, how long is that going to be? This daily sacrifice was an integral part of their religion. If you would compare it today to the prayers of the saints, what if someone, our government, put a prohibition, kind of like we've seen earlier in the book of Daniel, put a prohibition on praying? That any person, any individual caught praying to God was going to be killed. That'd be similar to what we see taking place here. Prayer is such an integral part of our religion and our belief that it would just be blasphemy for a ruler to come in and say, that's not going to be allowed anymore. But that was what was coming for the people of God. The daily sacrifice was going to be removed. And this angel inquires of another, how long will these things take place? How long will the holy people of God be trampled? So let me stop and just ask a question, and I put a few questions out in the back. I neglected to do so last week, but I got those together and put those back there. Maybe we can have a little bit of discussion. We've talked a lot about angels, but as you see the topic of discussion here between these two angels, does that tell us anything about angels and their relationship maybe with men or their concerns for men, God's people specifically?
It shows they do have some concern about what's going on.
Okay.
But it also shows they don't know everything that's fixing to happen.
Okay.
God has revealed everything to them.
Right. Yeah. I think of that passage in the New Testament that you'd mentioned, that angels, they do have obvious concern in men, and especially when it comes to God's people, which I believe we find angels interceding frequently throughout the Bible on behalf of God's people. And so as Daniel's witnessing this vision about terrible times ahead for God's people, these two angels are speaking to one another and they say, how long? How long is God's people going to be trampled because of their love and their concern for the people of God? And this other angel answers, and he actually speaks to Daniel, 2,300 mornings and evenings. Some may say 2,300 days. But we see here an obvious concern of these people in the affairs of God, the interest of God's people. And so the fact that angels know and angels are interested and angels are concerned about the going on of God's people, which are us today, can be somewhat of a comforting thought and tells us a little bit about angels. And then this one says to the other, how long are these things going to take place? The response to Daniel, actually, one of these angels asked it to the other. And in verse 14, we said, he, the angel, said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. So it's obvious that this information wasn't necessarily because one angel was curious of the other. Rather, it's to inform to Daniel how long this desecration was going to take place. And so this one angel says to the other, does anyone say 2,300 days or 2,300 days? Because mine says 2,300 mornings and evenings. So essentially there are two interpretations as to what's being the period of time that's being spoken of here. That is, you've got 2,300 24-hour days, which equates to 6 years and 111 days. Or some have speculated that he's talking about 1,150 evenings and 1,100, that's just like mornings and evenings, or evenings and mornings rather. So 1,150 evenings and 1,150 mornings. And I'm using the New American Standard, and that's actually how it translates it, as 2,300 mornings and evenings. And so you'd have just split down the middle, 1,150 evenings and 1,150 mornings, as a result of that being 3 years and 55 days. And some have looked at this and tried to determine, okay, exactly how long was it? And they've tried to crunch the numbers down to the very date in which the temple sacrifice and the daily offering was removed until it was finally restored. Once again, as we've seen frequently throughout the book of Daniel and the use of this type of literature, oftentimes these numbers are more symbolic than literal. And so this angel says from one to the other, it's going to be 2,300 mornings and evenings. I would lean toward probably the latter interpretation of this passage. The reason being, in Josephus, a Jewish historian later records that it was for 3.5 years that this prohibition occurred. And so that may be something you take into consideration. But more so, not because of the specific number itself, which is 3 years and 55 days, is exactly what it equates into. You'll remember, I guess it was a couple of weeks back, how we looked at the number 3.5. And how earlier in chapter 7 it was, the fourth beast was going to persecute the people of God for 42 months, which is 3.5 years. And as you consider this time span of 3.5 years, it seems to be representative of a time of persecution, a time of hardship, but a time that's going to have a definite end. You know, remember the occasion with Elijah when he said it's not going to rain in Israel 3.5 years? Okay, that was the 3.5 years of famine that occurred, hardship on the people. God's people were challenged during that time because of the famine. And so 3.5 years, I would probably lean toward that interpretation, because you're talking here about a period of persecution that's going to occur amongst God's people. But anyway, it's obvious that whether the angel is speaking literally in the sense of 24-hour days, or if he's speaking in the sense of 3.5 years, it's a symbolic number, because history doesn't really corroborate either of these dates exactly. But the important point being, so just we don't get lost among the details, it's going to come to an end. These terrible things are going to happen to the Jews, but God's not going to let it last forever. There's going to be a time when sacrifices are once again brought back into effect, temple worship is restored, and this great persecutor of the Jews is going to be brought down to earth. And that's what we want to not lose sight of, that God's going to once again show himself as every ruler who has placed himself and challenged God. God's going to accept that. God's going to come forth victorious. And this time's going to end. And we'll read it a little bit next week, and we'll see how God's going to go about dealing with Antiochus Epiphanes, this great persecutor of the Jews. So any thoughts, comments, questions on anything in verses 9 through 14? Yes.
In verse 14, we talk about what came Okay, he could be talking about a 12-hour day, and he would have a whole 3 year, 4 day, that's 4 hours.
Well, say that again. Why can't he be talking about a 24-hour day?
No, 12-hour
day. Okay. That's the second interpretation. Some have looked at this and said that he is talking about the 12-hour days. And the way the Jews kind of broke down their day, we've got the 24-hour day. They also had a 24-hour day, but they broke it down into two parts. Going all the way back to Genesis, where we read about the creation accounts, how after God finishes creating on one day, it said it was the evening, and it was the morning, and it was the first day, the second day, so forth and so on. And so they broke their day into two parts. It started with the evening. The evening was the first part of their day, from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And then the second part of the 12-hour day, from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. And so some have looked at that, H.B., exactly along that same train of thought of what you're saying. And that's what I myself lean toward, that rather than 2,300 24-hour days, he's talking about 2,300 evenings and mornings, that is 12-hour periods. And so rather than 6 years, you've got this period of time, 3 years and some change. And so breaking it down between the 12-hour part of the day that's considered evening and the 12-hour part of the day that's considered morning. That's one of the interpretations of that passage. So you're spot on with that. Anything else?